Pod with Paddy and Andy.
If the opposition can't smell blood this year, we're as well pack it in, because even if Comerford's kickouts are as good as Cluxton's, every team is taking a step forward.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
A new year is full of surprises, but one thing is always predictable. Postage costs go up. Stamps.com gives you crazy discounts of up to 89% off USPS and UPS services. So when postage goes up, your business will barely notice the change. Stamps.com is like your own personal post office, wherever you are. You can even take care of orders on the go with the mobile app. No lines, no traffic, no waiting. Schedule package pickups, automatically find the cheapest and fastest shipping options, and seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. There's even a supply store where you can stock up on mailing supplies, labels, even printers. Stamps.com has been indispensable for over 1 million businesses just like yours. All you need is a computer or phone and printer. Take a chunk out of your mailing and shipping costs this year with Stamps.com. Sign up with promo code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com code PROGRAM.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power's Save Our Game, donating 10k to Irish football for every goal England score at the Euros. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
It is coming home. Sunday night, 8 o'clock, England, Italy, 1966 and all that. It's going to be a long few weeks ahead, I think it's fair to say. David Myler is with us. How are you keeping, David?
Nathan, I'm good, thanks, Paul. How are you?
How's all in England?
It's bonkers. As you said at the top of the show there, it's coming home. They fully believed it from, you know, beating the Czech Republic. You know, looking at that side of the draw there, you know, everyone had their eyes on who they could play in the final. And then, look, they're in the final now. They beat Germany, dispatched the Ukraine and beat Denmark. They're there. Everybody's just so excited. I'm almost jealous. You know, it's, I've been talking, like, if you look at like Ireland in the, you know, the Euros in 16, obviously when we beat Italy and the impact it has on the country, and you kind of like see all these people who aren't really into football come out of the woodworks and they're buying England kits, they're supporting England. Kind of jealous that, you know, we're not experiencing something similar.
I keep reminding myself that it's okay for England to respond like this. It's okay for them to celebrate like this, because I remember what I was like that night in Lille when Robbie Brady scored that goal and how we just totally lost the run of ourselves. I remember we were on air for about an hour afterwards and there was no Irish player had ever done anything wrong. Nobody had ever misplaced a pass in history, and we just went with it. And that is what they're doing. Everything is perfect right now.
And that's the scary part is, like, you've got to give Gareth Southgate some credit. Every decision he's made, he's got right. Like, from the opening game, there was uproar over Sterling starting. He played Tyrone Mings and John Stones. He played Trippier left back. And then, obviously, he's slowly progressed, even against Germany, switching formations. He's just got every call spot on. Even the smallest thing of last night, bringing Grealish on, who there has been outrage and outpour for him to start every game. And then he takes him off. I heard it was a knock, but then it turns out that he brought him back off for a tactical, you know, situation. But, you know, it pains me to say it, but there's something special going on with that group.
I think we can hear the commentary, can we, from Sam Matterface last night as England made it through to the final.
You might not have been on a journey like this for a little while, so I will quickly remind you of the safety protocols. It is best to keep your seatbelt fastened at all times, and if you have a tray or a table, I would use it. Spillages have been known. But if England get to their desired destination, it will be worth a tummy flip or two. Good luck. Saved back in! Yes! 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 It's a goal that cranks the volume up across the nation. England lead in extra time. And the good times never felt so good.
The That was Sam Matterface on ITV's coverage last night as England progressed to the final. David, I would feel I'm like a lot of Irish people watching this in that I look at the English squad and see a very likeable group who you want to do well. Yet, when I'm watching the match last night and Harry Kane, that scores that penalty, I'm kicking the table. I'm annoyed. I want to see Denmark. I'm kind of done with it. As a former Irish captain living in England, what are your emotions like watching last night?
Do you know what? It's difficult because I have a lot of friends who are playing in the team. Yeah, I want them to do well. Like, I spoke to, I think, seven of them yesterday before, like, around lunchtime. Just chit-chat and wish them well. Gareth Southgate's a very likable character. I like the way he conducts himself, the way he carries himself, the way he speaks. I look at the group of players. Who's the biggest personality in that, or the biggest player? You'd probably say Harry Kane or Raheem Sterling. To a certain extent, Phil Foden. Like, they're likable guys. There's no egos there. There's no real nonsense with them. It's just, you know, Southgate's likable. The players are likable. It's a strange one because we're so used to hating England for so long that when they kind of, they're doing well now, it's kind of like, not like I'm overly fussed if they win or lose. It's just weird because, like, I'm married to an English woman. Like, my wife and daughter watched the game last night and they're screaming and chanting and everything. And my wife has got England kits for the kids. You know, but it's as much as it's different for me. They've had the Ireland kits since they were born. She is their mother as well, and she is English. So it is tough.
They've, like, Declan Rice'd it.
I've not Declan Rice'd it.
The kids have. They were all in Ireland. They were kissing the jersey and now they're kissing the England jersey.
Well, it's what you call it, because I've had that conversation with my wife, my father. Like, what happens if my son turns up when he's older and wants to play for England? Look, I know before anyone jumps on any bandwagon, we're a million miles away from that now, right?
But go on, like, what happens?
Well, I don't know. That's the God's honest truth. I don't know what's going to happen. Because obviously, if he turns around to me and says that I want to play for England, of course I want him to play for Ireland. But if he turns around and tells me he wants to play for England, what can I say to him?
And look, it is a strange dynamic. And I'm not saying people should be here cheering for Declan Rice and for Jack Grealish, but we can't get away that Grealish, Rice, Harry Kane have an Irish heritage as you go back. And I was making the point earlier in the week, like, they didn't leave Ireland because they wanted to leave Ireland in all likelihood. They left Ireland because they had no choice but to leave Ireland. And while we'd love them to be playing for Ireland, they've made a different decision and they're all the better for it, it seems, right now. On the performance then, and what Gareth Southgate has done with this team, you're talking about who's the biggest presence. When is Harry Kane the biggest presence in that dressing room, do you think, or is he just the captain and actually there's other figures in there who are maybe a greater presence within the dressing room?
This is just my personal opinion. I don't think Harry Kane is... he's probably a different type of leader than what I'd be used to. And certainly the way he comes across, he's very professional, very serious. Almost like, look, he's a typical striker. He's very selfish, wants to score goals, wants to be the main man. We've seen that. I've no problem with all that. I don't think he's the kind of fella who's pulling people up in the change room or, you know, grabbing hold of the fellas. I don't think he's that type. I think he leads by his professionalism and the way he carries himself. So I imagine, look, obviously, most people are well aware I'm good friends with Jordan Henderson. He certainly would probably be one of the vocal ones in the changing room. I think that's why Gareth was so, like, desperate to have him in the squad. You know, when there was obviously, look, because if you strip it back and, like, Jordan hadn't played in 3.5 months and then to be named in a 26-man squad, you're kind of thinking, like, well, is he going to feature? It's going to take him a lot of time to get up to speed with everything. But I think with Gareth, he sees kind of the bigger picture of, I need that type of character around the changing room for those younger players. I imagine Harry Maguire is very vocal. He's come on a lot since he's become captain of Manchester United. So there were, like, I'm not saying that Harry Kane will be quiet. I think he'll say a bit, but I think there'll be two or three other voices that will kind of spur on the group of players as well. So I think it's kind of like you'd have Harry Kane, but he'd be the quiet version. You'd probably have Jordan and you'd have Harry Maguire then kind of, like, pushing the lads on. But you'd have someone, if you look at it, then you've got, like, Kieran Trippier is a very experienced pro, has been around for a long time in and around the England team. Kyle Walker's the same. John Stones. They have some good personalities that you'd want in a changing room.
It's still not a straightforward situation for Jordan Henderson, as mature as he is. And as influential as he is. He wants to be playing. Like, England are playing in a European Championship final on Sunday, and he wants to be starting. How difficult is that, do you think, for him as a pro to be that leader in the dressing room, while also, I suppose, looking at Gareth Southgate saying, I want to play here, and actually maybe Rice and Phillips' impact on the tournament has diminished a little bit over the last few games as we've got into the knockout stage that were very impressive during the group stage, but maybe not had quite the same level of control. Do you think there's a possibility that actually Southgate looks at Henderson and thinks, I'm ready to make that change for the final?
No, I don't. I think the two, like Rice and Phillips, I think they've earned, you know, their stripes from the games that they've played to this point. They've started all the games. They've gotten this far. I don't think you change it. I know where you're going with, obviously, his added leadership. You could see when he came on last night, there was kind of a safe pair of hands to kind of take on that responsibility. But I think, you know, the two boys have done really well.
I'm more talking actually just from performance levels, because like you compare the two midfields, and if it's Barella, Jorginho and Verratti going up against the two of them, like, it feels that, is Declan Rice playing within himself a little bit? Like, is he doing the job that Gareth Southgate wants? Because we saw him progress at West Ham in the last couple of years, and it seemed as though he could do it all, he could turn, whereas now he seems to be just playing it so safe.
Well, maybe they're, you know, the instructions he's been given by Gareth. Like, Declan is obviously a holding midfielder. It's not, his job is more about stopping the attacks. That's why you kind of play two holding midfielders, to allow the fullbacks to get forward and join in. I think last night was a prime example for the opening 15-20 minutes. Like, England looked very nervous. Obviously, they'll have that experience with 2018 being in a World Cup semi-final. But I think you could kind of tell in the opening, like, as you said there, Rice and Phillips were giving them all away. You look at Pickford's kicking, which is, you know, one of the strongest assets he has. Like, he was trying to clip balls into midfield or into, like, you know, the wide areas, whatever, and they were getting cut out. And there was just a lot of nerves, and I think the emotion kind of played into that. Obviously, look, for the majority of them, you know, that started, it's the biggest game of their careers, you know, albeit the lads who probably played the Champions League final, which would be probably classed as bigger because it's the semi-final. I think that factored into a lot of it. But then at the same time, hopefully they can use that experience going into the final, and then they can, you know, say, okay, well, I've done this 5 days ago or 4 days ago. I'm kind of prepared and I'm ready for it, and I know what to expect. Because going from the Ukraine game in Rome, where, look, there was always going to be England fans there, but to come back to Wembley for the semi-final, 65,000, you know, they've seen the outpour of love from, you know, across the country, across the world for them, you know, the English people everywhere. So I think there was a big factor of emotion and everything, and I think that last night will help them going into the, you know, the final Sunday.
Harry Maguire started the tournament injured, but has come in and has been excellent so far for England. When you think back to your days with Hull, did you always see this in Harry Maguire? Did you always see this level of ability, that he could be an England centre half on the verge of winning a major tournament?
If I'm to be completely honest, no. It was only when he went to Leicester. I remember I had a conversation with somebody. If you remember, I can't remember the exact dates now, what games it was, but Gareth was in charge and he'd come out and he kind of said, we want to play out from the back, and he dropped Chris Smalling. And I remember turning to who I was with and said, Harry Maguire will start in the World Cup because he's so comfortable on the ball and so good at coming out. You've seen it from, you know, the Czech Republic game where he played that pass to Harry Kane where he stepped out. Like, that's one of his biggest assets. Now, of course, you kind of feel sorry for Tyrone Mings because he did well in the opening game against Croatia, albeit the Scotland performance wasn't brilliant, but, you know, he didn't do anything particularly wrong because they didn't concede. But then again, Harry is a level above him. You know, that's why he's at Manchester United. That's why he's captain. So kind of knew that it was only a matter of time before Gareth brought him in. And look, the partnership he's built up with John Stones has been phenomenal. So, like, to answer your original question, no, at Hull, I didn't expect him to go on to be this. Certainly when he went to Leicester, you could see massive signs in you know, in his development. I imagine if you were to sit down with him for an hour and have a chat, he probably plays a lot of work that Brendan Rodgers did with him.
Right. He was obviously probably 21, 22 when you were together at Hull. Was he a natural leader in that dressing room?
No. Harry was relatively quiet. But then again, it's tough because, you know, he come from League One, from Sheffield United. He signs with Hull. You know, you come into a change room where there's lads who are, you know, full established internationals, been part of a successful Hull team. You're kind of, you know, the young boy. It's a bit like Andy Robertson. I did a piece there recently when I was asked about Andy Robertson, and I said Andy was quiet as well. Took him about 3 months to speak to us. And then all of a sudden we thought, who's this cheeky little Scottish fella? they kind of matured as time went on. Like, we're also going back, like, what is it, six years ago from when they signed. So, like, the amount of games they played, the amount of big games, that is, like, you know, whether it be the World Cup, Andy, with, you know, winning the Premier League, winning the Champions League, those experiences will help them develop. I don't think anyone could have hung their hat on them, you know, back in 2015 when they were playing for Hull, to think that they were gone to this level. I knew Andy had a couple of levels in him. I knew Harry had a couple of levels, but I didn't expect them to get, you know, like, if you want to call a spade, like, Harry is one of the best centre-halves in the world. Andy Robertson is one of the best left-backs in the world.
Maguire looks more comfortable at England than he does even at Manchester United. Maybe it's the system that they play in. Maybe they're more comfortable with Rice and Phillips and there's no great expectation for them to do anything except protect the defence. As you look towards what Italy will bring, how do they get at the two England centre-halves, considering teams have really struggled to get at England at all during this tournament?
Well, that's the big thing, is you've spoken there, is how do they break down kind of midfield partnership of Rice and Phillips? I think that's the key thing. Like, Immobile's been very hot and cold. He's shown glimpses in games. Like, of course, then you've got Insigne, who's renowned for his pace, his low agility to, you know, but then he's up against Kyle Walker. And like, time after time, you see Kyle making these darting 40, 50-yard sprints to, you know, get back into position to retrieve the ball. It's going to be very difficult. I imagine they'll have to have a game plan, like, of Mount trying to limit Jorginho getting on the ball, and Verratti. He's going to probably have to do both of them, because Jorginho would probably be more the one that will stay. But I think the game will be won or lost in midfield. I think whichever three can get on top of the other ones, you know, should really dictate the tempo of the game. It's going to be tough for England because, you know, Jorginho's in fantastic form. Barella, as we know, got an incredible goal against Belgium. And then, of course, Marco Verratti, he's been doing it for years. So it's going to be very difficult.
We shouldn't just brush over the fact, of course, they got there by cheating, David. They got there by cheating. Did Raheem Sterling dive?
I don't think he dived. I'm not going to say he
fell
dived
to the floor easily.
No, I'm not going to say he dived. I think there is minimal contact. I don't think it's a penalty, though. It's just, we've had such a great tournament, and like, nearly all the VAR has been done, you know, it's been looked after, it's been quick, there's been no faffing with lines drawing, everything has been really professional. And that was the kind of first incident during the whole tournament. It was just a shame that the game was decided on that moment alone, you know. Like, of course, England were, you know, the dominant team. They looked like they were going to, you know, if either one of the teams was going to score a winning goal, it was going to be England. I don't think it's a penalty, but I do think there is minimal contact. He is knocked off, but I mean, the referee's given it, so there's no point talking about it, really, is there?
Are players told to go down in that scenario? As you say, there is, and I know a lot of people said there was no contact whatsoever. You know, I saw Kevin Doyle making the point that there is very minimal contact, and when you're running at the speed and the way that Raheem Sterling does, minimal contact's often enough. And we see situations where actually people get clipped and they don't go down, they don't get the penalty. Like, Raheem Sterling, there does seem to be a bit of a pattern here that when there's a touch, he's going down. But is he actually doing the right thing?
He is doing the right thing, yeah. He's giving the referee a decision to make. Look, you're a Liverpool supporter, I am too. There are probably some Liverpool supporters. Sadio Mane is the prime example. He tries to stay up on his feet as much as he can. And as much as we applaud him, say, look, he's not going to ground, as opposed to, say, someone like Salah, who will throw himself to the ground. Like, Mane doesn't go to ground. And then there's uproar kind of going, well, go to ground, you'll get the penalty because there is contact. So like that, it's such a difficult one. But if, look, you're told, like, managers have told you before, if you're in there on the box and you do feel contact, like, don't be the hero staying on your feet, go to ground. Like, I think that's kind of obvious. It can be classed as cheating or whatever, but if you get knocked and you get a little clip or a touch on you, you know, you go down because you want to get the penalty, because inevitably it's win by all costs. You know, you're just so desperate to win. And whether or not it's a penalty or not, like, Raheem Sterling, referee has said, look, I'm deeming it as a foul. It's gone to VAR. They've not told him to check the monitor. They've not tried to convince him it's not a penalty. He gives it. Harry Kane, albeit, yes, he's saved, he scores. England are through to the final. So you've got to understand that those small little touches, that's why managers kind of tell people, look, go down.
It has overshadowed the fact that Sterling was brilliant again last night and could well end up being player of the tournament at the end of this. It's obviously quite a while since you would have played against him. When you think back to going up against Sterling, a young Sterling, where would he rank in terms of the talent that he had and how difficult he would have been for defenders on your team to play against and to try and quash his influence?
He's just so electric. His pace, like, I think in Liverpool, he was a bit raw. He relied so much on his pace. No, like, since he's gone to Manchester City, he's come on leaps and bounds. And I think that's the big thing with him. Like, he's so clever at his movements, going, like, you know, the prime example of the chance he had, like, that ball down the side to Saka, who pulls across. Yes, he should score. That's probably his own downfall, is probably his ability to strike a ball. He should be scoring more goals. But you just can't leave him get a run on you. He's so sharp over, like, you know, the opening 10, 15 yards. And when he gets in front of you, you can't catch him. That they've got to limit the space in behind. That's why Gareth went with him, because Harry Kane is phenomenal at dropping, getting the ball on the half turn and playing it forward. Prime example is the goal. Comes in, plays Saka down the side. He whips it in, albeit it's an own goal, but Sterling's there to tap it in. They've just got to, like, Italy are going to have to limit that space in behind them, and they're going to have to be tight and kind of, you know, rough him up a bit. Raheem won't like that.
You mentioned Jack Grealish and the substitution. Firstly, the decision then that Gareth Southgate faces for the final, and whether there's an opportunity for Grealish to start, whether it's Saka, or whether he actually decides against the Italians, I'm going to go with three at the back and maybe bring Trippier back into the side and play Kyle Walker as a back three. Do you think he's found his system and he's happy to go with that and believes in that? Or do you think actually he might be thinking, Italians, totally different match, I'm going to go back to what served me so well earlier in the tournament?
I think he's nailed on to play the same, the 4-2-3-1. I think Saka stays in the team. I think he just brings great energy. I don't think Grealish will play. I don't think he'll start. I think he'll come on and feature at some point, depending on how the game obviously goes. But why would you change it? Like, he only changed for the Germany game to match them up. You know, I felt last night he could have, because obviously Denmark play, you know, the wing backs, and they play the three centre half. So I thought last night he could potentially go back because it worked so well at Germany. But it's very good management from him, because he has a system in place where he can just swap and change between formations, and he's got so many different players. You'd have probably covered at some stage the uproar over how many right backs, but then, like, the only one that hasn't probably featured is Ben Chilwell. Like, out of the fullbacks, I know I said right backs, but out of the fullbacks, they've all kind of got, you know, moments on the pitch and they've all played. So, like, he's done a masterstroke, and I think that team last night has got him to the final, and I think he'll stick with them, provided nobody has knocks or, you know, picks up a slight injury in training over the next couple of days. I can't see him changing too much.
Yeah. Grealish coming off again, like, there were times with the ball at his feet, with the trickery, that he asks a lot of questions. He also seemed to give the ball away quite a bit. And it was interesting with the Danish substitutions as well. It seemed to completely stop their flow, even though they were tiring. Yeah. And you looked at Damsgaard and Dahlberg and thought maybe they were running out of legs. But the substitutes brought no momentum at all. Like, Poulsen was atrocious. Like, kept giving away free kicks, couldn't keep a hold of the ball, didn't add. In a game of that magnitude, are substitutions actually a risk where there's so much intensity, so much pace, that do you think it takes longer for the substitutes to come on and be able to make an impact?
Oh, 100%. Like, substitutes are massive, because you're brought on to obviously make an impact, as you said. You come on to change the game, whether that be you're chasing a lead or you're trying to defend a lead, whatever it may be. Like, Denmark made three substitutions at one time, and it just completely knocked the flow of them. They couldn't get into rhythm. And the hardest thing is, when you come on the game, it takes you a couple of minutes to get going. Don't care who, like, I look back at my own experience. If you remember when we beat Austria 1-0, I came on after about 20 minutes for Glenn Whelan because he pulled his hamstring. But, like, it took me about 10 minutes to get going. Like, and then, you know, that it's so difficult. And then a game of that magnitude in the, you know, European Championship semi-final, like, everybody was kind of calling for Southgate to make substitutes. You could see it all over social media, you know, bring on Foden, bring on Grealish, bring on X, Y, and Z, whatever. The thing is, the players who are playing are in a rhythm in the game. They're up to speed with it. It's very difficult for a substitute to come in. And you could see that with the Danish players. Like, they come on and, like, they made them worse. You know, Dyberg and Hamsgaard were doing reasonably well. Obviously, like, they were tiring. You know, high expectation, big game, big moments. But it just completely knocked the flow. And then Thomas Delaney, when he went off, it just knocked them even more in the middle. They had no legs. They had no energy. They had no desire to press players, get after them. They just kind of fell apart. And then England looked like they were only going one way then. But that's the difficult thing of managing or being a manager, is you have to make those big decisions at key moments. And look, if the Denmark manager makes those substitutes, say they were to play the game again tomorrow and he makes those three and they come on and they change the game for Denmark and they go on and they win, then it's genius. But then obviously knocks their flow, they end up losing. So it's, you know, if you win, you're right, and if you lose, you're wrong. But it definitely upset the balance of them.
All our football coverage and Off the Ball is with thanks to Paddy Power. Save Our Game. They're donating €10,000 to Irish football for every goal England score at the Euros. And after yesterday's semi-final, Southgate's men have already hit the 100,000 guarantee, and still an opportunity for them to surpass it in the final. It's all with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. Just on Gareth Southgate then, and like the job that he has done. You go through this England squad, and it always, it seemed, there's a lot of good lads in there. Like you mentioned Henderson and Maguire, Kane, even for his brilliance, outwardly doesn't seem to be a massive ego. You see what Raheem Sterling and Marcus Rashford have done away from the football pitch. There's something within that squad already. How much of that ego that I'm talking about is down to Southgate? How much of it is just that he's got quite fortunate to have all these players at the one time?
Probably a bit of both. I don't think Gareth would allow any egos. Even, you know, the way he speaks and the way he carries himself, like I said earlier, like there's no real nonsense with them. The players then, like you said, it's just massive. If you go back to the inverted commas golden generation, where you have Beckham, Gerrard, Lampard, Rooney, like Ferdinand, Terry, Ashley Cole, they're huge characters. And like they were challenging year in, year out for Premier League titles against one of their Champions Leagues, where there had to be some hatred creep in. Like, you know,
Rio Ferdinand spoke about it recently, saying that he didn't want to give Frank Lampard an edge, that when Lampard would go back to Chelsea, that he would have learned something off Rio Ferdinand. Like, yeah. How debilitating is that for any squad?
Yeah, exactly. And that was England's biggest downfall. It's just those players were all kind of club first, country second. And then they couldn't, you know, put it to one side when they came. Like the whole idea that, you know, Gerrard, Lampard couldn't play together in midfield is nonsense, because but it was probably a bit of rivalry between them, because, you know, they were both competing at, you know, like I said, in the Premier League and the Champions League, that they didn't want to kind of accommodate one another. They didn't want to. Whereas this England squad, it's just everybody is together. Like you see the celebrations, all the players, like even the whole thing of like Grealish coming on and coming off, that like we trust in Gareth. Gareth has made that decision. Like he came out and said, I have no problem with that. You know, the manager is doing the best for the team and I'm the one that has to be sacrificed. I have no problem. Like for any footballer who's brought on and brought off, it's seen, that's demoralizing. Like, but the whole, there's a bigger picture with Gareth. And that's like, that's the scary thing, is because obviously he had his time with the 21s. He took over the senior team and he sees the bigger picture. Like I imagine he's heavily involved with the underages, like watching the development of players. Like he's on top of everything, and just, I'm jealous. And that's why, like, I've been on this show before talking about Steven, like his predecessors, Martin, Giovanni, Mick, were all kind of brought in to get results. Whereas I think with Steven, there's a bigger picture in place. You know, I think he sees the development. He's had his time with the 21s. And I think like, that's why we have to be patient with Ireland, that it's going to take time, because a lot of these players now we have are very young. They're all like 21, 22, that we'll see the rewards in maybe 2 years when they've, you know, more established, they mature, get more games under their belts. And that's what, going back to England, I think that's what Gareth has done. He's kind of brought in that.
Well, it feels like it's flipped completely from that golden generation era where, going in with England, the pressure was so intense. Whereas now, maybe because the club managers are with, you know, when you're with Jurgen Klopp and the intensity that we hear he brings to training every day, what Pep Guardiola demands from his Manchester City players, that actually for Raheem Sterling going in with England, there's a sort of calmness of Gareth Southgate, that this is a safe place for them actually, where you can express yourself that little bit more, that maybe tactically, because it's international football, it's never going to be quite as in-depth and as deep as you're going to get with Guardiola, that it gives them a little bit of freedom and a bit more space.
No, definitely. And the big thing as well is, Nathan, it's only a small detail, but it's stuff you start to pick up on. You look at, look, Sky Sports, like the coverage of England is like everywhere. Like you cannot get away from, there's some player doing an interview somewhere. But the big thing I've took from all is they all reference him as Gareth. They call him Gareth, which is like, you know, it's not Boss or it's not Gaffer or it's, you know, it's Gareth. So there's that kind of human interaction on, like, as you said there. But when Sterling comes in, he probably feels like Gareth has my back. Gareth, trust me. Gareth knows what I'm bringing to the table. But there's this great camaraderie and a bond between them. Like, I said it earlier, I'll say it again, but I'm jealous of it. You know what I mean? It's almost, it's nice to see. Do you know what I mean? That they're just a group of 26 players with the manager and coaching staff. They're all pulling in the right direction. There's no nonsense. There's no
crap. David, your wife and kids have brainwashed you.
No, they haven't. They've not brainwashed me. But no, but you have to be objective to it, you know? Mm. It's not like the golden generation where I grew up, like supporting Liverpool, where you hated Manchester United or whatever, and you didn't want to see those players doing well. Like you can, anyone who listens to this, watches this, you can go through and find me a player that you don't like and tell me why you don't like them.
Mm.
It's not like the other, you know, like we talked about those boys, the Rooneys, the Gerrards, the Lampards, the Gary Nevilles, the Carragers, the Terrys, the Rios, Ashley Cole. There's enough reasons to dislike them, but this group does something different. And I, you know what I mean? Fair play to them.
When in your life cycle at a club do you decide what you're going to call the manager? Is it already assumed when the manager comes in you're going to call him Gaffer or manager, or do you need special permission to call him by his first name? How does all that work?
I don't know. Right, some like Steve Bruce was always Gaffer. I always called Martin O'Neill Boss. I had heard in the past that Martin didn't like Gaffer. You know what I mean? Because it's kind of seen as a foreman on the construction site or something. But I don't know.
So did you ever call him Martin?
No, I still call him Boss now. I still speak to him every now and then. I'll ring him and we'll have a catch up or whatever, and we'll have a chat. I still call him Boss.
So was there any manager you called by their first name?
I don't think so. No.
Right. So it is actually quite unusual that the players would call him Gareth.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's why I brought the point up.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking Marco Silva was Boss, Linus Schlutzky was Gaffer, Brucey was Gaffer. Mick Phelan was a difficult one because Mick was obviously assistant and everyone knew him as Mick or Mike. I call him Mick, probably more of an Irish term. But when he took over manager, like somebody like joke, like, do we call you Gaffer now? And he started laughing. Like, you know, so that was kind of when someone transitions from an assistant to a manager is very difficult. Like going back, Roy Keane was Gaffer. I actually just remember that one of my first days. I went, "Hi, Roy." Anyway, it's Gaffer.
Wow. And did you not say, is there not some sort of Cork understanding here that I'll get special treatment? I can just call you Roy?
No, in Cork, we are a Langer boy. There might be a bit more, like, but. No, but that was the thing. I suppose Roy is probably one of, like, Steve Bruce, I still call Gaffer to this day. I suppose it's just more or less a respect thing, I think.
Right. We've got James Richardson of Football Italia fame and Football Weekly and all that coming up in a moment. So we're going to talk a lot about Italy with him. Just on Italy then, and the challenge that England are going to face. You mentioned their midfield and how the midfield battle is crucial. So Rice, Phillips, Mount, up against Barella, Jorginho, Verratti.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like there's only one winner.
Verratti, Jorginho and Barella.
Mm.
Yeah.
Is that how you see this going?
I'm a huge admirer of Marco Verratti. Incredible player. Albeit people will moan saying he doesn't turn up in the big games from Paris Saint-Germain, the latter stages of Champions League.
But yeah.
It's easy to say that sitting at home on the sofa.
Well, I heard you talking about him on OTBAM the last day. What about Jorginho then? Because obviously he came in for huge money at Chelsea, and maybe part of the way we look at him is influenced by N'Golo Kanté was moved out of his natural role and impacted by the arrival of Jorginho, and he's seen as one of these traditional holding players, 100 passes a game, 100% pass completion rate, never takes much of a risk. Is there more to him than that? Have we seen more to him than that in this tournament?
Yeah, I think you have. I think the biggest thing with Jorginho is people would be quick to jump on playing. He's playing sidewards and backwards. Jorginho is a master at controlling the tempo of a game. Like the prime example would be Busquets, who's done it for the best part of like 12 years. He controls the tempo of a game. Now, Busquets is obviously a better version of doing it, but Jorginho is very clever. He can slow a pace down that if they're under pressure, he can get hold of the ball. That's why he'll find it difficult against someone like Mason Mount, who's young, energetic, and will press him all day long, which I imagine will be Gareth Southgate's plan. They'll have to get after him, because if he's given the run of the game and he's allowed just get on the ball and knock it around willy-nilly, then he'll cut them apart. The biggest thing is he's passing it 5 yards to a left to get it back to almost upset the balance and rhythm of a team's formation or their shape. That's why he does it. It's not a case of he won't play forward. He's very good at like doing that. And obviously Verratti does something similar, but he has the unique trait of being able to drive forward with the ball and carry it, almost commit a man to like pull one of the midfielders out of position to then pop a ball forward through. That's why I said to it, that game will be won or lost in midfield. England have to get after them. They have to run all over Jorginho and not leave him at the run of the green.
So what's the plan in the Myler household on Sunday?
I'm working for the game, thank God. Uh-huh. They've all got England kits. So I imagine they'll be...
One of your mates
will
sort you out with tickets for the family?
I've been offered tickets.
Oh.
I could go. But I'm working. So I'll work away and I'll watch it. I predict Italy to win at the start of the tournament. I know Jurgen Owen will be watching this back waiting, because I have to go on and sing a bit of Andrea Bocelli if they win.
In your boxers, is that what you said?
No, I'm not in my boxers. Give me a break.
You sure?
Yeah. No, I'm not doing that.
But if they some lucky Paddy Power pants for you if you want.
I actually have a pair. Paddy sent me a pair. Do you remember when Paddy did the thing with Mayweather against Connor?
Yes, yeah.
I remember speaking to Paddy. Gave me a great tip of what round Mayweather was going to win in. Because he was in with the Mayweather camp and he said, oh, talk around his camp is here, 8 or 9. So we all jumped on 8 or 9.
Didn't pass it on,
I don't remember which one it was. But.
So you're rehearsing for the weekend, then you'll be rehearsing late, and that is coming up if Italy win on Monday morning.
Conte partiro. Yeah, so time to say goodbye.
All right, we look forward to it. A lot to look forward to this weekend. David, great stuff as always. Enjoy.
Cheers. Thanks, Nathan.
David Myler there. James Richardson is up next.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power's Save Our Game. England's goals total 100,000 so far for Irish football. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
All right, welcome back to Thursday's football show. Nathan with you. We are building up to the final of Euro 2020. We've just had David Myler on, talking mainly about England. But we do want to talk about Italy and, well, England as well, because we have a guest who is going to have some split loyalties, I guess.
A new year is full of surprises, but one thing is always predictable. Postage costs go up. Stamps.com gives you crazy discounts of up to 89% off USPS and UPS services. So when postage goes up, your business will barely notice the change. Stamps.com is like your own personal post office, wherever you are. You can even take care of orders on the go with the mobile app. No lines, no traffic, no waiting. Schedule package pickups, automatically find the cheapest and fastest shipping options, and seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. There's even a supply store where you can stock up on mailing supplies, labels, even printers. Stamps.com has been indispensable for over 1 million businesses just like yours. All you need is a computer or phone and printer. Take a chunk out of your mailing and shipping costs this year with Stamps.com. Sign up with promo code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com code PROGRAM.
Sunday night, or maybe not, James Richardson is with us. How are you keeping, James?
Pretty good, Nathan. How about you?
I am very well. I'm looking forward to this. I've really enjoyed this tournament so far, and it's going to give us the grandstand finale we want. Do you have split loyalties?
No.
No?
I'm entirely neutral.
Right. You gave us, you are responsible, I think it's fair to say, for most people in this part of the world, their love of Italian football and all things Italian. You don't need to play it down. I think it's for people of my generation, it's 100% true.
That's very kind of you, but that's a little bit like saying the mailman who delivered the $1 million check to your house is the one responsible for making you rich. Italian football made you fall in love with Italian football and Italian cities and Italian ice creams and all those other things as well. But it was very much Italy, but I mean, I was delighted to have been a part of that. But thank you very much.
This Italian management team as well, of Mancini and Vialli and Attilio Lombardo and so many of that Sampdoria side. Was Football Italia on air when Sampdoria won Serie A?
No, sadly not. We that was, when was that, 89, 90? And we started in 92.
Right. But so, it was synonymous with that sort of era.
Yeah, very much. I mean, the early years, particularly Samp, one of those sides that I think everyone, certainly English fans would follow because of David Platt, but also because they had this very kind of simpatico image and a beautiful kit. And they had Mancini playing for them and just generally like Veron, young Chiesa, you know, the father, all sorts of great players, Carambeo. Anyway, so Samp were very much the part of it, but they were the last kind of provinciale, kind of provincial team to win the title. After that, it became a lock for the big sides, at least until the Romans, who I guess you could call big sides or not, started to win at the turn of the millennium.
Would you have been aware that that team had always stuck together, that always had that sort of bond, that here we are 30 years later and so many of them are so influential with the Italian side?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, particularly Lombardo and Vialli and Mancini, who at the time were known as I Gemelli del Gol, the gold twins. They were seen very much as a pair. But the whole team, that Samp team, was famous for the fact that they would hang together in a way that maybe wasn't that common or that widespread among Italian football. They would, led very much by Vialli, they would get up to all kinds of japes together. So I think brotherhood was very much a strong thing for them. And it's beautiful to see, actually. Gianluca Vialli, as you probably know, has been through a lot in the last couple of years. And for him to be back and working with Roberto Mancini, to see the two of them embracing after Italy's score was really, really heartwarming.
Mm. How open is Mancini to feedback from his backroom staff? Is it a very democratic process, or is he the main man and everybody else just stands back and get their time to input, but really the final decision always rests with Mancini?
Well, I mean, I would imagine the final decision always rests with Mancini. That's actually, to me, one of the most surprising things. I've not been party to their tactical discussions, but my assumption with Mancho is that he's a pretty strong-minded guy and can be quite fiery as well. And I would have assumed that he would have been maybe not the most open to discourse, but by all accounts, what has happened with Italy hasn't just been the fruit of his own personality, his own vision, but it's very much a process that the Italian Federation have put in place. And the collaboration, to use a kind of Italian equivalent word, but I mean, the tactical influence of the junior Italian sides has had a huge bearing on what he's been doing. So in that sense, he has got with their program as opposed to them falling in line with him.
Right. That's interesting because, listen, it's something here in Ireland we would talk about, of having your under 16 team playing as the same way, right, that the under 21s do in the senior team. And you often wonder, you know, does that work, or do you play to the players that you have at your disposal? So this, for Italy, is a cycle that has been coming through in a style of play that when they're with the national side, most of these players are well used to playing with from underage level.
That's right. And you say there is this thing, you know, do you go with the best system for the players you have, or do you go with the system that the players have been bred for? But in Italy's case, and I guess this might be the situation with other countries as well, those players, this is actually the best system for them because they are players who have come through the junior sides, the various youth teams that Italy has, and therefore they are used to it. So it actually fits them. And if you've been watching Italy for a while, I mean, you'll be aware that Italy are coming off one of the most disastrous experiences ever under Giampiero Ventura, when they managed to miss out on even going to the last World Cup. So how Mancini has been able to work this change has been one of the big mysteries. But the fact is that it is actually something that's been ready to come through, and it's now, because that generation is coming through and is available, that that he's been able to with obviously his own direction, being able to, you know, reap the fruits of everybody's labours. Mm.
There's a humbleness in that as well, because we expect in the modern era the manager to come in and have such strong opinions of how he wants to play the game, to actually come in and look at an underage system and look at the players and think, they know how to play this way, and I am going to sacrifice maybe some of what I believe in for the betterment of these players to get the best out of them. Was he always like that? Has he changed his ways? Was the Roberto Mancini of Manchester City willing to change like that?
Well, okay, so I'm not the expert on him at Man City. I just remember him kind of training around bus stops and telling everyone to get screwed just before they won the title. I mean, I have tremendous respect for Roberto Mancini. He was probably my favourite player of the era that I was in Italy. As a player, though, he had a very short fuse, and he was known as well as being very single-minded, pretty fixed in his ideas. There was a lot of talk that when, for example, Sampdoria did win the title in 1990, that it was actually Mancini who was the manager, that the guy who was nominally the allenatore, Vujtin Boskov, was essentially this kind of feel-good, cuddly Yugoslav uncle to the team, but it was Mancini who pretty much called the shots. And then he ran that team. I mean, he was Sampdoria for so many years that the feeling was he ran that team. What we're seeing with Italy, I think it's a nice thing that it dovetails very much with how he likes to play, with his vision as one of the most, I mean, the Italians would call it Estrosa, one of the most kind of creative, one of the flair players of his generation, a fantastic number 10, that it dovetails with the way that Italy are playing. But possibly the Italian Federation, in a rare example of joined up thinking, actually selected Mancini because he fits with their program rather than it being a total coincidence. But however it came about, I think it's worked out fabulously well. Having said all of that, I fully expect England to beat Italy on Sunday night.
Right, straight out there. Why do you fully expect them to win?
Well, so the Italians have one or two things that put the wind up them, and I don't think that this is that they would deny this. And I think one is people playing at them with speed. I think another one is teams that put pressure on them. And at club level, English clubs have generally given Italian sides an awful lot of problems because they can't deal with the pressure. They can't deal with the pace. The Italians, they're not. It is a different style of play in Serie A, and it is a different pace as well. And you have the feeling almost that the members of the team are almost like, can you just hold up a second? I'm trying to play some football here, as the English players kind of whiz in on them. Now, this Italian side has been a bit different, and certainly in the group stages, they were pressing high themselves. They were getting into their opponents' faces. They were doing many of the same things we've seen done to them in the past. However, the game against Spain, we didn't see that from Italy. What we saw was them beginning the game brightly, and then as Spain began to establish some kind of midfield dominance with their extra midfielder, they retreated and they kind of fell back on their default being camped out around the box and basically just hoofing it away. It was a little bit similar to how Denmark reacted to some of the English pressure last night, but I actually thought that Denmark did it better. The Italians were pretty ragged. We've seen them operate that kind of system in the past and been a lot more coherent, shifting as a unit, whereas this was fairly last-ditch stuff. They got through against Spain, I think largely due to the terrible Spanish finishing. Would they be so fortunate if they were to exhibit a similar kind of mentality against England? I don't think so. Now, the other thing about this is that I mentioned club level and the fact that Italian sides have had issues with English clubs in the past. At national team level, it is true that Italy has had the better of the few meetings that they've had at tournament level. And even in any kind of competitive match, you have to go back to, I think, 1977 to find an England win. However, the Italian papers, while mentioning this today, are pretty upfront saying, you have to go back to 1977, but this is the best England team since 1966. So if Italy come out the way they did in the group stages, or the way they did against Belgium, I guess, and put pressure on England and maybe kind of force them into second-guessing themselves a little, and maybe can get lucky on the break, and if Immobile can have a good game, because my goodness, he's crying out for one, then Italy definitely have the potential to do something. If Verratti and Barella have a better game than they did against Spain, because I think they were a big disappointment, then possibly against Phillips and Rice or Henderson, if he's there, then the Italians can establish some dominance in midfield. But I think, I mean, there's two things that come out of this. One is Immobile, because you can have all the gameplay in the world, but without, if you know, if you're if you play the way that Italy are probably going to do against England, they will probably be kind of camped at the back at some point, trying to hit balls out, you know, release maybe Immobile or him hold the ball up so that the rest of them can join in. At the moment, he's not looking like he's going to do that. The second thing is that the player who looked the bravest, the player who looked the most composed, the player who looked like he brought the most to the Azzurri in terms of dynamism in those wonderful group stage games is Spinazzola, and he simply won't be there. And whilst Emerson Palmieri was, by most standards, pretty impressive the other day, you couldn't help but feel that Italy weren't sure who the kind of the baton had been passed to, who was going to go out, as Spinazzola had been doing, and effectively dragging the team up the field, leading the charge fearlessly against the opposition. Without that, I kind of fear that the Italians might retreat into something of a classic mindset against this swarming England side.
Right. David Myler was on just before you talking about that midfield battle. I'm just wondering, is that where the opportunity is for Italy? Because England don't have a Busquets or a Pedri who can maybe control the game the way they could. Is there a chance there that Jorginho, Verratti, Barella can actually take so much possession for Italy that swarming England, they can actually frustrate them, just keep the ball off them, and that will give them a level of control that actually they can maybe go and win this game or dominate this game?
There absolutely is a chance that that might happen. You're quite right. And I guess that's the difficulty of talking about anything as chaotic as a football match, anything as random as a football match before it actually happens. But yeah, you're absolutely right. If that happens, we could be in for a classic game. I think if it goes to penalties, I would certainly back the Italians after their performance the other night. But Jorginho is such a huge part of that. He I thought, was very good against Spain in difficult circumstances. But yes, that is going to be a key thing. And I mentioned Verratti and Barella not impressing, and maybe they will have a better game. Maybe they will find a little bit more time, a little bit more composure. I'm really looking forward to the game. I don't mean to suggest that Italy necessarily will be negative, but having seen Italy come up against teams with a lot of personality, with a lot of aggression in the past, what has classically been the case is that they have, even if they start boldly, just withdrawn. And I think against England, leaving them room to play in would be potentially catastrophic.
By the sounds of it, you've been, like most people, incredibly impressed with what England have done so far and what Gareth Southgate has been able to achieve. Last night's performance in particular, like the way the Danes faded, maybe a lot of that was down to what England did as well. Is this the best England team you've seen since 1966?
So, I'm very flattered by the question. I have sketchy memories of most England teams, indeed most things that happened beyond last week. It certainly, to me, I don't recall being thrilled by watching an England team play the way I have been with this, or I don't remember seeing an England team look this comfortable against decent sides the way this side has. Whether it's the best squad, I don't know, but I guess that's not really your question. Against Denmark, there was interesting because based on England's performances so far, and certainly against against Ukraine the other day, I think most people thought that Denmark were going to end up at the wrong end of a similar scoreline, and the Danes really were having none of it. They were extremely composed. They played with huge personality. They did ride out the early English pressure and gave England a lot to think about. Certainly in the first half, I think Denmark took control of the game. England responded to the goal really well, but Denmark were very much in that match. I think that, sure, what England do in terms of the number of ways in which they can hurt you must mentally exhaust any opponent they come up against. But I think it is also, without in any way wishing to be churlish, mentioning the fact that it did get taken to extra time. They did win on a fairly controversial penalty. And they were playing a Denmark side who, at that point, only had 10 men, whose players were pretty much all cooked, who'd had to travel around from... Okay, they had a couple of games at the Parken, but they also had to go to St. Petersburg. And then especially, they had to go and play that game against the Czech Republic previous to this, all the way in Baku, which, you know, Baku beyond, what was it, sort of 2,000 miles away from the nearest one of the two teams that featured there. And huge drain on the players, not just in terms of travel, but also the temperatures they played at. So I think that had England played their quarterfinal in Baku and had Denmark played at home and this game been played at the Parken, would the outcome have been the same? I'm not so sure. Full credit to England getting through to a final, but I don't think that they necessarily dominated. I'm sure you don't think either, that semi-final. But you know what? It's all, however you get there, they got to a final. And, you know, you're allowed one or two games along the way in which you kind of grind it out. And, I guess we'll see what happens on Sunday.
Yeah, and, geez, it's a monumental occasion. And even been hundreds of miles away watching on television, it had that wondrous tension that big tournament football has, where you're on the edge of your seat. And I didn't really mind who went through, but you're just waiting for something to happen. You don't want somebody to make a mistake. There's going to be over 60,000 people there. I don't want to say it means more to England than it means to Italy, particularly for the Italian players that are involved.
No, but it's a really interesting point that, and actually the Gazzetta points sort of makes reference this morning, that there's going to be this massive support for England, but that could be a double-edged sword, to use that phrase, because it does mean so much to England. Italy have been to finals. They have been world champions in 2006. They have been to a Euro final against Spain in, when was that, 2012. But they're used to the big occasions. They're used to getting this far. It's part of what they do. And if they don't do it this time, I think that they would be among those teams that go home with their heads high. We came, we impressed a lot of people, we made some friends, we made it to a final. That's fine. It wouldn't be an issue. England have been waiting since 66 to make it to a final. There's that sense, even if this team is full of young players who could just as well in 18 months' time do brilliantly at the World Cup, there's that sense that you just never know what football's going to do, what life's going to do, that will this opportunity come around again? And will that weigh on the England players' minds? I don't know, but it might. You can imagine that if the game doesn't start well, that feeling that we got this far and it's slipping away from us could be a really powerful powerful factor in the game. I hope it doesn't. I hope we have a wonderful game against which both sides express themselves to the utmost. And, we can reach double figures for scores and all that kind of thing. But, yeah, I mean, that's if we're all feeling the tension over here, then Lord knows what they must be feeling.
One last question on another of Mancini's backroom staff, Alberico Ivani, who has intrigued a lot of people, the slickest looking man on the sideline. Obviously, after the first match at Wikipedia, and realised this isn't just some random coach, this is a player who had an unbelievable career. He was part of that great AC Milan side, played in the European Cup final, was on the bench when they won 4-0 in 89. Obviously, looks very different now, but an assistant, but somebody who could manage Italy in his own right based on his playing days.
Yeah. Kikovani, yeah. So he's such a figure. Also, because the thick glasses and the thick moustache, it makes it look like he's someone who wasn't given time off work but decided to go anyway and was just bought a disguise at the airport, which, you know, possibly is what he's done. I'm not sure. It's a fascinating backroom staff. And as you say, he's a kind of direct line back to one of the great tactical switches of recent Italian football, which was Sacchi's Milan and the way they absolutely went to press the opponent. They absolutely looked to play all over the field. And they were the antithesis of that sit back and try and hit on the break Italian mentality. So to have him part of that, I don't think is any coincidence at all. It's also great to see one player who you may have seen wandering around with a big beard is Daniele De Rossi, the great Roma midfielder. It's a fabulous collection of players, and Mancini just doing brilliantly at the top, looking unbelievably elegant. Italy, you may have also spotted, have dusted off their uniforms from the 1982 World Cup, which is interesting. They started out with those kind of collarless numbers. Mm. And then when they got to the knockouts, they went full for this kind of like pop-in, as they call it, pinstripe, blue and white light jacket with the tie and the dark trousers, which is classic Bierzo at 1982. And will it bring them the fortune they desire? I don't know, but it's an interesting move.
I am trying to think of my feet, but I presume if there was a five-a-side competition between the coaching teams at the Euros, Italy are winning it comfortably. Unless Shevchenko has one of those days.
I'm not going to disagree with you, but yeah, I'd have to look at the coaching squads of the other 24 teams. But you'd like Italy's chances.
Mm, yeah, Steve Holland probably would struggle against some of these lads, it's fair to say. James, enjoy Sunday night. You're going for an England win?
I would forecast an England win. I'll be surprised if they don't. Yeah.
All right. Great to talk to you as always. Enjoy the game.
Thank you.
James Richardson there. This is the football show on Off the Ball. All our football, as you know, is with thanks to Paddy Power's Save Our Game. Remember, they're donating €10,000 to Irish football for every goal that England score at the Euros. Yesterday's couple of goals means that Southgate's men have already hit the 100,000 guarantee and still a chance to surpass it in the final. It's all with thanks to Paddy Power for information on responsible gambling. Visit gamblingcare.ie. If you missed any of that with James Richardson or David Myler, just download the OTB Sports app, subscribe to the Football Show podcast, and you'll get all that good stuff.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power's Save Our Game. England's goals total 100k so far for Irish football. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.